Hello, this is Rita Schulte, and I'll be reading today the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette from Thursday, October 17th, 2019. We'll begin on the first page with an article about the University of Illinois by Julie Wirth. Headline: Speakers say sexual coercion tip of iceberg. Policy overhaul must consider gender harassment, they say at special summit. Blatant examples of sexual misconduct may get the headlines, but most harassment isn't sexual at all. It's more of a put down that come on as one put down than a come on, that is, as one expert put it. As the University of Illinois grapples with sweeping proposals to combat sexual misconduct, speakers at a sexual harassment summit Wednesday said it will take more than improved reporting procedures or training programs for universities to build a healthier climate. This legal landscape is changing, and so is the moral landscape. Changing culture and cultivating bravery are the things we need to move forward, said U of I anthropology professor Kate Clancy, who co-authored a landmark study on sexual harassment of women in STEM fields for the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Clancy and two psychology professors who also worked on that study, Lilia Cortina of the University of Michigan and Vicky Magley of the University of Connecticut, both UI alumni, refuted common myths and misperceptions about sexual harassment Wednesday. Most people tend to think of sexual harassment as coercion, making a job or emotional opportunity or educational opportunity contingent on sexual cooperation. That is, sleep with me or you're fired, Cortina said. That's actually relatively rare, reported by about 1% of the women in university studies, she said. More common is unwanted sexual attention, touching, hugging, groping, and the like. But those numbers are typically under 5%, she said. Most complaints fall under gender harassment, sexual or sexist remarks that convey hostility or second-class status to women. It's not about misplaced sexual desire, flirting, or romance gone awry, she said. It's about contempt. The National Academies report refers to it as an iceberg, with sexual coercion and unwanted sexual attention at the top and everything else below the water. From obscene gestures to relentless pressure for dates to sexist comments, such as women don't belong in science. The tip of the iceberg tends to be the focus of policies, reporting procedures, and training programs, Cortina said. But the research record is clear. More often than not, sexual harassment is a put-down, not a come-on, she said. Another myth, that the slights or indignities that denigrate women aren't as damaging as physical harassment. Studies show that's not true, she said. The National Academies report analyzed 88 studies involving 70,000 women for the impact of different types of harassment, and found that gender harassment had at least as great an impact, if not greater, on personal and professional health as sexual coercion and unwanted sexual attention, she said. Why? The latter two are traumatic for the individuals involved, but they tend not to be as frequent, as she said. Less intense forms of harassment are more common and often go unchallenged. Even harassment that consists of sexist insults take a toll on victims, Cortina said. Too often, Clancy said, women are told to brush off those behaviors. But in a study on sexual harassment in astronomy and planetary science, a significant number of women said they had skipped professional events, such as colloquia, field experiments, or networking events that could further their careers because they felt unsafe, Clancy said. The study also found that women of color reported much higher rates of harassment than white women. About 40% of women of color said they'd been made to feel unsafe at work in the last 5 years, compared to 27% of white women. That's an astounding number, she said. Clancy also puts in perspective on fears about false accusations smearing a faculty member. False reports do happen, as with any crime, she said, but they're rare, anywhere from 2% to 8% of all sexual harassment reports, she said. The issue is that we hold overwhelming skepticism over credible claims of sexual harassment and assault, she said. If you're worrying about a shining star professor, you're worrying about the wrong person. Excessive concern about false allegations can also shape faculty members' behavior in a way that hurts their effectiveness as mentors. Professors who stop having one-on-one meetings with students or decide not to engage in difficult conversations to push a student academically, for example. That's gender discrimination, she said. The solution is not to disengage from people. Magley said, improvements to harassment reporting and training programs are helpful, but not a silver bullet. Sexual harassment reporting is considered a last resort by victims and is fairly rare. A 2016 study showed only 6% of those who had experienced sexual harassment filed formal reports. More commonly, she said, victims will avoid the situation, seek support from friends, relabel the behavior as something else, blame themselves, put up with it, or try to appease the perpetrator, she said. One big reason is a massive fear of retaliation, professionally or socially, she said. People worry about being demoted, denied training opportunities, shunned or excluded for complaining about a colleague, Magley said. Until we can figure out a way to make people safe in their environments and not fear retaliation, perfecting the system of reporting won't solve anything, Magley said. Universities need to set appropriate sanctions for misconduct and actually enforce them, she said. And training programs need to be more than one and done, she said. One study showed little difference in knowledge about sexual harassment between those who had gone through training programs and those who hadn't, except on questions of law, which is what most training focuses on, she said. To move the needle on sexual harassment, Cortina said, universities need to transform their culture to be more respectful and treat all people with dignity. U of I law professor Rob Carr, who chaired the committee that released the U of I report this week, said its approach was to go way beyond the law into a culture of bravery, a culture of common sense, and set up a broad range of sanctions to be more responsive to the problem. We want to be modeling good behavior policies so people can go out into the world and bring that with them, he said. And another story from Page One by Ben Zigderman. Headlined, Champagne Dispensary Gets License. Phoenix Botanical also plans to change its name. Adults will be able to purchase recreational marijuana legally without leaving the city limits come January 1st. With less than 3 months until Illinois becomes the 11th state where recreational marijuana is legal, the applications of 6 more cannabis dispensaries were approved this week, including one at the existing medical marijuana dispensary in Champaign. The license means that Phoenix Botanical, 1704 South Neal Street, will become a dual-purpose dispensary, both medical and adult use, said Jason Erkes, spokesman for Cresco Labs, which owns the Champaign business. The 55 existing medical marijuana dispensaries statewide have first dibs on the new licenses. The first 5 were granted in August, with the closest among those being in Effingham. The area's other medical cannabis dispensary, NewMed in Urbana, is also seeking a license to sell recreational marijuana. We are planning on opening an adult-use dispensary, said Tina Clayton, the agent in charge of the shop at 105 East University Avenue. With the approval of Phoenix Botanical, each of Cresco Labs' 5 existing dispensaries in Illinois is now licensed to sell recreational marijuana. As part of a national rebranding, Phoenix Botanical will change its name to Sunnyside. The new brand aims to make marijuana more approachable, with a bright aesthetic and education for new consumers, according to Cresco Labs. The state also has opened up applications for 75 brand new dispensaries, which will be awarded by May 2020. Only one will be allowed in the area covering Champaign, Ford, and Piatt counties, one covering McLean and DeWitt counties, two covering Douglas, Coles, Edgar, Iroquois, and 10 other East Central Illinois counties, and one for Vermilion County. As the state processes dispensary applications, city councils and village boards across Illinois are deciding where those businesses can be located and how much sales will be taxed. The City Council of Champaign and Urbana have both passed a 3% sales tax on marijuana sales. Champaign expects an additional $625,000 to $955,000 in annual revenue, and Urbana could see another $275,000 to $550,000. And also from page one, an article about the Champaign City Council by Adalberto Toledo. Its headline is, Concerns About One Board Prompting Overall Checkup. Calls by one Champaign City Council member to consider the disbanding of the city's Citizen Police Review Board 2 years after it was created have the leader of the five-person group asking one question. Why? Emily Rodriguez, the chairwoman of the city's Citizen Review Subcommittee, said Wednesday that she can't imagine what we could have done to upset council member Clarissa Foreman, who a night earlier called for a study session to look into the idea of Champaign's Human Relations Commission absorbing the subcommittee. I'm not convinced we need them to be a separate entity, Foreman said Wednesday. Before I did, but the actions of the chair recently led me to believe they do not. Council members voted unanimously on Tuesday to act on Foreman's recommendation of studying at a future date the roles of its boards and commissions, including the Citizens Review Subcommittee. It's just a study session, Mayor Deb Finan emphasized Wednesday, and not at all an endorsement of getting rid of the subcommittee created in 2017 to review the police department's investigations into complaints filed against it. My intent is to look at the ordinances and check in on what work they're doing, Finan said. This is our newest board, and it took 2 years to get it in place. We always expected tweaks along the way. We certainly didn't expect perfect language when we set it up. At issue is the subcommittee's role, which was defined in part in the city ordinance that led to its creation as promoting, quote, thoughtful policy recommendations and ongoing research, end quote. In addition to its duties as an, quote, unbiased review board, end quote. But when review board members proposed to Champaign Police Chief Anthony Cobb in May a series of changes to the process by which the police investigate complaints, some council members questioned whether they were overstepping their bounds, as they are a review board, not a policy-setting board. Foreman said that some subcommittee members' appearance at Tuesday's council meeting, along with other comments made on social media, quote, makes me believe they do not understand their duties, end quote. A night earlier, she further alleged that boards and commissions, including the Citizens Police Review Board, have been using city staff time inappropriately. Asked about that charge Wednesday, Rodriguez was stumped, saying she hasn't heard any complaints or indication that her committee has abused staff time. If anything, I've learned a lot about professionalism from their example, Rodriguez said. I think we've been swept up in some city council infighting and drama, but city staff is used to dealing with angry residents, and they know it's complicated work. I think up and down we have a good working relationship. Rodriguez also said she couldn't understand why anyone would want to fix something that's not broken, referring to Foreman's approach on this issue as combative. If they're displeased with the language of the ordinance, that's fine, but we're not made for this kind of theatrics, Rodriguez said. We're looking forward to getting back to work and talking about recommendations. This is distracting from the work we're doing. It seems to be a wrench in the machine. Subcommittee member Alexandra Harmon Threat, who spoke at Tuesday's meeting, said she hopes council members recognize the value of having citizens play a part in examining police complaints. I hope the city and the council remain committed to the citizens and the promise they made to make independent review a reality. Harmon Threat said on Wednesday, I'm really hopeful that in their study session research, they discuss how citizen review boards work in other cities so they understand how far we have to go and how much improvement can be made to the process. You should hear and understand your constituents' concerns, she added. Again, this is not something we dreamed up and not something brand new and never been done before. Many other cities have these measures and they work very well. Contacted Wednesday, Councilmember Tom Bruno said he wasn't ready to support the idea of folding Rodriguez's group into the city's Human Relations Commission. He said he was, quote, caught by surprise, end quote, when the study session request was circulated on Tuesday night, but still supported that component because it's healthy to have a review of our boards and commissions. It's chicken soup to me, he said. Typically, with a study session request, they do ask for some action, but still good because it's always healthy to look into this. My review could mean there's no changes or vast changes. I just don't have the facts to make that judgment now. Finan said the study session could happen as soon as 3 months from now. When we do have that meeting, the mayor said, we're going to reach out to the boards and commissions so they can read the study and appear if they want to. And we continue to Section B, the local section of the paper. An article by Deborah Pressey, headlined, Brothers Charged in Holdup. Prosecutor wants younger sibling 16 tried as adult. Two Champaign brothers were arraigned in adult and juvenile court Wednesday on charges related to an armed robbery Tuesday morning at a Champaign bank. A Champaign County judge set bond at $1 million for Jakir D. Pickens, 18, who listed an address in the 300 block of East Park Street, on two counts of armed violence and one count each of financial institution robbery and aggravated battery with a firearm. The same charges were filed against his 16-year-old brother, who appeared in juvenile court Wednesday. State's attorney Julia Reitz said she has filed a motion to prosecute the 16-year-old as an adult, and a hearing on that motion has been set for October 25th. In laying out the facts in court, Reitz and Assistant State's Attorney Matt Bannock said police were called at 11:30 a.m. Tuesday to Regions Bank, 111 South State Street in Champaign, for a report of a robbery in progress. When officials arrived, they found an employee bleeding from a head injury. Reitz and Bannock said further investigation revealed that the two suspects entered the bank together, both wearing hoodies, hats, and sunglasses. One was wearing a blue hoodie and carrying a loaded firearm, while the other was wearing a black hoodie and gloves. The prosecutor said the suspect with the gun grabbed an employee by the hair, demanded money, and fired the gun into the ceiling. The other suspect followed another bank employee who had fled to the back and returned after that employee got out of the building. Reitz said a female employee who refused to provide access to the locked teller area was hit with the gun repeatedly in the head, causing a bleeding wound. The suspect with the gun also fired several rounds at the bulletproof glass, then kicked the glass, leaving a clear shoe print on it, Reitz said. She said after the two were unable to access the locked area of the bank, they fled and changed clothes in an alley. Reitz and Bannock said the robbery was captured on a surveillance video, and a witness outside the bank saw the pair flee, turn into an alley, and leave wearing different clothing. The witness provided a description of the pair to officers who located them nearby and captured them after a brief foot chase. Police said they recovered the blue hoodie and a .22 caliber firearm in the area where the two suspects had been seen. County Public Defender Jamie Miller Jones said Pickens is homeless, unemployed, and suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. Pickens asked for time to hire a lawyer. Kennedy set his next court appearance for October 23rd. And here's today's column by Jim Day, headlined, The Rich Are Different, Especially Their Income Tax Returns. When the late U.S. Senator Paul Simon held public office, he made it a practice to release his full federal and state income tax returns every year so people could see where he made his money. Today, this frugal and perfectly proper gentleman was scrupulous in reporting his income, puts it mildly. The guy even reported as taxable income the few dollars in rebates he was paid for using his Discover credit card. He didn't have to do that. Then there was his stock portfolio. Simon wasn't a big investor, but he made a practice to purchase a small, way less than 100, number of shares in companies whose business practices he admired. Some of the companies paid dividends, and Simon, a lifetime politician who worked his way up from the state legislature to the U.S. Senate, dutifully reported them. He did have to do that. Because he was keeping no secrets, Simon's tax returns were more peculiar than newsworthy, interesting because of what they said about him. He really reported his credit card rebates as income? He owns 6 shares in the XYZ company? What's with this guy? For starters, Simon was an honest man who was not only totally averse to cutting corners, but willing to go the extra mile to reassure the public of his devotion to personal integrity. More important, Simon was well off, but certainly not a rich man, at least by the standards of his time, and certainly not by today's standards. His tax returns were neither complicated to put together nor to understand. That's not the way it is for today's ultra-rich public servants. Former Governor Bruce Rauner is a self-made multimillionaire. Currently, Governor J.B. Pritzker is the scion of a wealthy family, is a much billionaire. He is so rich that the $170 million in personal money he spent getting elected for governor is mere pocket change. Pritzker released income figures this week from his 2018 federal and state returns. He didn't come close to releasing his full tax returns because he understandably figures it's private and he doesn't want people nosing around in all the details of his financial life. Rauner felt the same way, as did Chris Kennedy, who released income figures but not his income tax returns during his unsuccessful run for the Democratic Party's nomination for governor in 2018. Suffice it to say, understanding Pritzker's finances would be complicated, at best, even if he released his entire federal and state income tax returns. So it's impossible to gain a full understanding of them after his release of a few summary pages. Forbes magazine recently reported Pritzker has a net worth of $3.4 billion, but Pritzker reported 2018 income of $5.5 million to the Internal Revenue Service. If he was getting a 10% return on his net worth, Pritzker would have received $340 million. So even allowing for illiquid assets, including his multiple mansions, Pritzker's $5.5 million income represents less than a 1% return on his total assets. Here's another peculiarity. His campaign reported that Pritzker Family Trusts in 2018 paid $5.3 million in state taxes and $29 million in federal taxes. So his trust paid a combined $34.3 million in taxes, while he reports $5.5 million in income. Get this, Pritzker reported the maximum allowable capital loss of $3,000. Governor Moneybags had a capital loss. Whoa, wouldn't this Schedule D capital gains and losses be interesting to examine? Pritzker's total federal income tax owed was $2 million plus, but his total federal tax payments were $4.5 million, just $1 million short of his $5.5 million income. Here's another weird item. Pritzker was fined $19,144 by the state for underpaying his estimated taxes, even though he was entitled to a $399 refund. That's a neat trick, underpaying estimated taxes to the point of being assessed penalties while overpaying. Pritzker applied that refund to his 2019 state taxes. So what's up with Pritzker's tax returns, which speaks volumes but in a whisper so low they can't be heard? This guy is rich, rich, rich. He's got more money than God. Beyond that, it's too complicated for mere mortals to understand. And from page B2 of the local state section, the legislative update from the Capital News, Illinois. Headlined, Lawmaker Calls for Ethics Task Force. A Republican state lawmaker said Wednesday she plans to introduce legislation to establish a state ethics task force to tighten ethics rules within Illinois government. To have the public's trust, we must take action whenever confidence is broken, said Representative Tony McCombie, Republican from Savannah. We've seen the headlines of the FBI's recent activity, including raiding the homes of legislators, lobbyists, and offices within the state capitol. The cost of corruption is too high for Illinois to ignore. McCombie, who is chairwoman of the House Republican Organization, the political arm of the caucus, which works and raises money to elect House Republicans, said several events in the past year raises concern that the state's ethics rules are not strict enough. The first of which, she said, is the August indictment of State Senator Tom Cullerton, Democrat from Villa Park, on multiple counts of embezzlement from a labor union. She also mentions an ongoing and wide-ranging investigation centering on State Senator Martin Sandoval, Democrat from Chicago, whose state house and district offices as well as his home were searched by federal agents in September. Other recent events McCombie mentioned were a federal investigation into the campaign finance activities of former lawmaker and current state auditor General Frank Martino and Secretary of State investigation of State Senator Patricia Van Pelt, Democrat from Chicago, for possible economic conflicts of interest, for offering paid seminars to teach people about how to get involved in the emerging cannabis industry. McCombie indicated she hopes to have legislation considered in the upcoming veto session, which begins October 28th. Steve Brown, spokesman for Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat of Chicago, said he could not comment without having seen the legislation. He did, however, point to incidents during former Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's administration that also could be viewed as ethical lapses. The most notable of those, Brown said, is his continuing investment activity that included ownership interests in Sterigenics, the company that owns a medical equipment sterilization plant in Willowbrook that has been linked to higher cancer rates in that area. And here's a piece about Aunt Martha's Health and Wellness, headlined, Clinics Awarded Additional Funding. Aunt Martha's Health and Wellness, the only Illinois organization currently participating in the federal family planning program, was awarded more than double its original grant after several providers across the country declined their funding in a response to a Trump administration rule change. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the Title X program of an additional $33.6 million to 50 grantees in several states to buttress their family planning services. The funding became available, the department said, after 18 organizations left the Title X program rather than comply with statutory and regulatory requirements prohibiting federal funding where abortion is a method of family planning. Paul Garza, Aunt Martha's president and CEO, said the provider's new grant amount is more than $1.3 million. That's an increase of $825,000. Aunt Martha's will use the money to expand services, including wellness exams, testing for sexually transmitted diseases, and birth control to several of its facilities, Garza said, allowing its medical personnel to treat more than double the number of patients we're able to serve now. No one else in Illinois applied, so family planning services would not be available to thousands of women, he said. That's not an exaggeration, that's a fact. Aunt Martha's announced in its mid-July that it would forego $500,000 in federal Title X funding after the state's other two recipients, Planned Parenthood of Illinois and the Department of Public Health, made statements calling the family planning program's revised regulations unethical. The Department of Health and Human Services, in part, does not allow medical professionals who work at clinics that accept Title X grants to perform, promote, or support abortion procedures. On August 23rd, Aunt Martha's reversed its decision due to clarification that it received from HHS staff that can tell pregnant women they have three options: carry the pregnancy to term, give the baby up for adoption, or terminate the pregnancy and answer any follow-up questions, but cannot give a referral to an abortion facility. This has been Rita Schulte reading the Champaign-Urbana News Gazette from Thursday, October 17th. We'll be back in just a moment.